Houston Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
Joining us in Studio 3, as he does once a month, is the governor of the Commonwealth of Bell. Patrick, he will take our questions and yours this hour. You can get to him at 877-301-8970. We are streaming this live at WGBHnews.org. Hello, Governor Patrick.
Hello, Jim, and hello, Marjorie.
Hello, Governor Patrick. Great to see you, as
always. Can you say that on the radio?
I think I can.
See you.
Great to hear you.
Great to be with you.
Great to be with you.
Well, she is seeing you, technically, Governor,
you,
so
right.
She
just
can say this.
I put my glasses on so I can see right across the table here. So let's start with some of the big news stories of the week. It's been a crazy week for the whole casino situation. Steve Crosby, the chairman, as you know, has recused himself from being involved in picking the Boston casino, if there, indeed there is one in Everett or over by Suffolk Downs. A lot of gubernatorial candidates have said he should recuse himself altogether, step down completely as chairman. You stuck with him. You called, I think you called it just politics, all this maneuvering on Fox News. I think I saw that there. So what do you think? Is this, are you standing by him for now, or is he going to go eventually? What do you think?
Well, I think the big question before the – I mean, first of all, I don't think that under any of the rules has there been a breach of ethics or a failure of integrity. I think he was right to recuse himself because of concerns about the appearance of integrity around the decision in the eastern part of the state, in the Boston area, as you say. I think there is a big question about what happens at the commission in the event of a tie. They've been doing a lot of their work very, very well, and they have to answer that that question. My understanding is that they're going to take that up maybe as early as today.
You know, one of the issues, though, when you accepted the resignation, at least the second time that Olga Roche at DCF offered it, one of the things that I'm paraphrasing you, Governor, is you said when the public loses confidence, when it has faith, appearance issues, that sort of thing. Don't the same things apply, whether it's fair or unfair, to Steve Crosby? And I guess a corollary to that, one of my NECN colleagues said, and I think I agree with this, is that having him be head of the commission but not having any involvement in the Eastern Massachusetts casino is like being appointed head of Massport and say, but you can't deal with Logan. That is the
that sounds like the kind of comment that would be made by somebody from Eastern Massachusetts.
Well, it
who
might
thinks
be.
that Boston is the center of our world. As important as it is, the commission has been doing a great job, slower than a lot of us would like, but without a doubt, with great care and thoughtfulness, and I think that's good for us in the long run. I'm not one for sort of ritual resignations. To your original question, I think we haven't come to a point, and we shouldn't jump to a point that when people say off with his head, we should put that head on a stake at the gate. This is a hard job. It's going to be complicated. By the way, we all knew that, right? There's a lot of money involved. There is healthy competition involved, and the interests of communities, you know, as we've experienced it, where people say, "I like the idea of expanded gaming, but not necessarily in my neighborhood," is I think actually kind of predictable too. So the process is gonna play itself out. As I say, I think we should be practical or pragmatic about this, and there is a very pragmatic question right now about what happens in the event of a tie in the East. As I say, the commission has to resolve that question, and soon.
I'm assuming your response is, well, let's see what the commission says. What possible resolution can there be? 2-2 is 2-2, I assume.
No, but there, you still got to be able to break a tie, and it's not always by a vote. I mean, there are other ways to do it. Sometimes in real estate transactions, you go to, and I think actually this is true at MassDOT, you go to best and last offer, that kind of thing. You know, I've heard people say that in casual conversation, well, in the event of a tie, we start over in the East. There could be a number of – I want to see, and it's up to the commission indeed, to come up with their solution. It's got to be simple. It shouldn't be too complicated, and then we'll go from there.
Last thing on casinos from me, at least, Governor. Do you have any buyer's remorse at this stage? My sense from being able to speak to you once a month – is that your enthusiasm for up to three casinos in his Lotz parlor was far greater at the beginning of the process than it is a couple of years in. Is that a fair
description? I don't think that's fair. I mean, my enthusiasm and indeed my involvement had to be higher when we were trying to get a bill. Now we have a law in place, and it turns the responsibility over to a non-political commission, which is, I think, the right way to do it. And so expressing an opinion, my opinion just doesn't count for very much. I mean, I have views. I have some heartburn about any of these facilities being in cities versus outside the city. You know, put it on an island in the harbor, in the case of Boston. But that point of view doesn't count.
I think it'd be fun, actually. Take a little boat out to the casino.
I think it'd be fun.
I think it'd be fun,
but it's just an opinion. It's not a developer's specific proposal.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you want to speak directly to Governor Deval Patrick, who will be with us till 1 o'clock.
And just one last question before we get to the calls. The Herald's done a lot of stories in the last week about your foreign travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you defend these as bringing in jobs. But it is a lot of traveling, and we've called it basically junketeering, that you and a bunch of your fellows have gone to like 10 countries in 2.5 years. So what's your rejoinder to this? And where are the concrete results?
It's so interesting. We have invited your newspaper and many other media outlets to travel with us in one case. The last time we went to Israel, actually, the first time we went to Israel, in 2011, one newspaper and one TV station came along, and the newspaper reporter, after 2 days, was so wiped out he had to take to his bed and couldn't keep up with us. In the case of Israel alone, there are some 6.2 billion dollars in Massachusetts revenue and 6,700 people who work here in Massachusetts from some 200 Israeli-based companies, and that number has grown to that level on direct account of our having been there and built relationships, and that's one of the reasons why we've gone back. In every place we go, it's very. I mean, ask the business people who come along. We go with a specific emphasis on what our strengths are here in the Commonwealth, around education, around the innovation industries, the life sciences and biotech and clean tech and transportation, for example, and the whole range of digital technologies. And we meet with companies and with sector leaders who are compatible. And that's how doors get open. Now, whether those doors get walked through is up to the private sector. But I can tell you, for example, in the case of the mission to Israel, back to Israel in 2 weeks, a week or so. That is what has provoked your newspaper to comment so much. That when the requests were put out for people to come, I think over 120 people, 120 different companies, large, small, and in between, said they wanted to come, and they've been turning people away.
And they pay their own way, those companies
that
come.
Course, yeah.
You know, just one last thing on this whole thing. You just talked about appearances in terms of Steve Crosby and at being the head of the Gaming Commission with these conflicts. There is an appearance, though, that I think concerns a lot of people, that, you know, the Health Connectors in the midst of this massive overhaul, mm-hmm. and DCF and so forth. And maybe I'm wrong about this. I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, Governor, that you had criticized Mitt Romney when you were running for governor, because he was traveling all over the place, mm-hmm. in the last months of his time as the governor of Massachusetts, too. So what's the difference, you know, and address the appearance
issue?
No,
that's fair. That's fair. Look, I think that economic growth is critical to the future. And I don't think you can let your foot up off the gas. I think one difference between the travel I've done and that my predecessor has done is that the travel I do is on behalf of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And it has consistently been, and we have the results to show for it. You know, we have the unemployment rate went down again today to 6%. We are growing as of the end of last year 69% faster than the national growth rate. Last year, 2013, we added more jobs in a single year than in any single year in the 14 previous years, and that was the fourth straight year of strong job gains. We're back in the leadership business. That's the point. And in order to do that, you can't sit at the desk and you know, issue pronouncements and comment on things as a pundit. You got to get out and get engaged, and that means being engaged around the government, engaged around the Commonwealth, and engaged in the case of economics around the world.
Governor, one last economic development thing, since you brought up the term before we do get to the calls at 877-301-8970. You have proposed, or at least spoken about, lifting the cap on liquor licenses. And my sense, apparently uninformed, is the only people who would ever object to raising, getting rid of the cap would be people who have a liquor license who don't want others to have it. But I've read the heads of a couple of cities, like the guy who runs Lowell, I don't know if it's a mayor, city manager, whatever it is, saying he's worried about more facilities leading to more alcohol-fueled violence downtown. Why hasn't the cap been lifted historically, and is it going to be lifted prospectively?
Jim, I don't know the answer to the question why it hasn't been lifted in the past. And by the way, just to be clear, what we are saying is, you know, you ought not to have to come if you're Lowell or any other city or town to come to the State House and get legislation passed to get one more liquor license for your in order to enable your development or your mom and pop store to get going locally. That decision ought to be made locally. There are so many decisions like that that require the blessing of the legislature. And I'm not saying that across the board they should end, but we should limit the kinds of things that that come to the State House, to the things that really do have a statewide impact, it seems to me. And this is an easy one.
Are they likely to give up that power, meaning your colleagues?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of interest in it. You know, there are a couple of city council members here, Jim, in Boston, who have been pressing this, partly because the number of liquor licenses that are granted in the South End and the Back Bay compared to new facilities in Roxbury and Dorchester is just way out of proportion.
Yeah, we've talked about that. Yeah.
There was a development, I think, in Dedham. I think I'm remembering this right. In Dedham, that was where a big, promising development where the anchor tenant wouldn't make a commitment, was otherwise ready to, but wouldn't make a commitment because they were waiting for a liquor license, and that took months, if not years, to get resolved. And if we're really serious about growing opportunity and accomplishing that by growing the economy, then we just got to make it simpler for people to make their investment decisions and get on with it.
Okay, speaking of getting on with it, we're going to get to the phones, 877-301-8970, Governor Patrick.
Okay, Gail is calling from East Boston. Gail, you there?
Hi, Gail.
Hi, yes, I'm calling from East Boston.
Hi, Gail.
First, I'd like to preface my comment with the fact that I voted no as an East Boston voter on the Sands Casino.
Mm-hmm.
And so my vote was pretty much disrespected by the maneuvers of the Mass Gaming Commission, which decided to negate that vote by changing the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I would really draw your attention to the fact that five would-be governor hopefuls are calling for the resignation of Steve Crosby as chairman of the Gaming Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Highlighted by Joan Vanocki's editorial this morning suggested he resign.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it really a question of when he will go and not if?
Gail, you there?
Yeah, he's getting pretty intense. So, I mean, are we just not prolonging the inevitability of his resignation?
Well, I hope we're not just going to yield to, you know, cause sort of a mob mentality. I mean, my executive assistant of now, I want to say 25 years, maybe almost 30 years, is an Eastie resident as well, and she is so hot on this subject.
On which side?
On Gail's side.
Uh-huh.
Feels really, really strongly on this side. She follows all of the hearings, and Gail, she expresses the same concern you do about the. I think what you're referring to is when the vote happened, and then the developer cut a different deal is it the Revere side?
Right.
Am I right?
Yep, correct.
Yeah. And I think she feels, and it sounds like you do as well, Gail, that was not kosher. You know, the commission does get to make those decisions. I don't think that the resignation of the chair changes that decision. I think, as I said, the commission, in my view, has done its work well, not always making people happy, and I think that satisfied, And it's going to be that way when decisions get made. But I don't think that I think the remaining outstanding question is, in the case of Boston, what happens if there's a tie? And as I said earlier, I think before we got on the call, the commission's going to have to sort that question soon.
Gail, thanks. Did you either directly or indirectly to Steve Crosby or anybody who works with Crosby urge him to recuse himself from the Eastern Massachusetts?
No.
Okay. Back to the calls, Governor Patrick.
Sure. John is calling from Boston. John, you there?
Hi, John.
Good afternoon, Governor.
Hi, John.
How are you?
Great.
Thanks for calling.
This is John Ribeiro. I'm actually chairing the committee to appeal legislation.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what we were promised in this state is that we would have done casinos right, that casinos would be an economic panacea, and what we really have on our hands is a real mess. And what this whole process is highlighting is the fact that although many people would be negatively impacted, only a few are permitted to vote on this. And even then, as Gail mentioned, their vote can be dismissed. Now, as I said, we're going to put this question to voters in November. I'm hoping, Governor, that you would at least support the right of the people to vote. As you know, the Attorney General has decided that the question is unconstitutional and that we shouldn't be allowed to vote on it. But I think that on the basics, that everyone in the Commonwealth should have the right to vote on this.
John, we should just say before the governor responds, for those filling in one piece that you didn't, the ultimate decision is not made by Martha Coakley. The SJC, is the Supreme Judicial Court, is now deciding whether or not the question will be before the voters in November. I'm sorry, Governor.
No, that is the answer. I guess I just respond, John, to a couple of the other points you made. Nobody, certainly not me, ever claimed that the expanded gaming was going to be some sort of economic panacea. I also think it hasn't been a mess. It's been slow and unsatisfactory to those communities or those people who wanted it, who didn't get it, and frustrating to those who didn't want it and are getting it or may get it. And I think, in fairness, John, your position and the position of the advocates for repeal was what it was before the issues of the chairman's role in recusing himself from Boston. So that doesn't sound to me like a real factor either. It's a serious question, and it has been a serious question, whether expanding gaming was right for Massachusetts. But we have a democratic process for that, and we had a democratic process for that, and a pretty robust debate about it, as you know.
Do you support, as John just asked, John Ribeiro, thanks, John, for the call. Do you support the right of the voters to be able to cast ballots on this November?
Well, I think, I'm a little wary of government by referendum anyway. I think if they are entitled under law to get on the ballot, that's the end of it. If they're not entitled by law to have the question on the ballot, that ought to be the end of it, too. But let's not say that there wasn't robust debate over a course of several years and deep engagement by the elected representatives of the people on the question and a pretty decisive vote in the end.
You know, Governor, you just mentioned that the employment rate going down and things improving economically in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Part of the whole gaming thing, I always thought, it was the economic disaster we were in back in 2007 and 2008, that there was almost like a panic sense of, we need this because we need these jobs.
Well, you didn't get that from me.
But I think there was a sense among that people were much more enthusiastic about casinos then because of fear of, you know, an Armageddon, you know, and now things are looking a little bit better.
Well, you know, I mean, that certainly wasn't my my approach. I said just a minute ago, I've never seen this as an economic panacea or, frankly, even a centerpiece of our economic growth strategy. Our strategy has been based on investing in education, innovation and infrastructure, and that's a winning strategy. I guess I would say, though, Marjorie, to take care that because we are doing well, shouldn't mean that we should let our foot up off the gas. That's not a view about whether, you know, there should be or should not be a vote on repeal, but one wouldn't say, for example, that we don't want another life sciences company to move into Massachusetts because we got a lot of life sciences companies already.
Let's go back to the calls. He's Governor Deval Patrick. He's with you until 1 o'clock at 877-301-8970, Governor.
Okay. Gretchen is calling from Nahant.
Hi, Gretchen.
Hi.
Hi, Governor.
How you doing?
Hi, Marjorie and Jim.
Hey.
Hi.
I was up in your neighborhood yesterday. It's awfully pretty. We had we cut the ribbon on the new wharf for the ferry service from Lynn.
Very wonderful. I'm dying to take that.
It starts.
I think that's going to be fun.
I think it starts in. Is it early June? It starts on Monday. I'm sorry. It starts on Monday, and it's free for the first week.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's going
to
be great.
I'm calling to tell you that, or to ask you a favor.
Mm-hmm.
I have lived in the Haunt in public housing for 14 wonderful years.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've been blessed and privileged to be able to do that. Within the past 2 years, I have seen the downfall of the Nahant Housing Authority to the point where they really do not know what they're doing. And the woman who is the executive director is in a worse position. She has two other jobs and is juggling this situation that she's in, being our executive director, and just spent over $150,000 of the Commonwealth money on a paving project, which was not ADA, did not satisfy the ADA requirements.
Compliant. Mm-hmm. Curb cuts or something like that?
Disabled public housing, specifically for elderly and disabled. And her attitude is, well, it's what we can do to get a grant, and maybe we can fix it. It's very depressing because it's a beautiful place. The space that it's on is wonderful, but the wasted money is horrendous. We have two units that haven't been rented for over 3 months. We have people who have leases that have not been renewed for 3 years, and they're still paying their old rent amount. It's just a debacle, and I feel like it's so sad because up till now, it was really run well, efficiently. She is just very dismissive of the people in the building and very dismissive of anyone who wants to volunteer to help do anything.
Wow.
So I wonder where I go. I've been in touch with Elizabeth Hayer in the past, but she is gone now, and I really need some help.
Well, let me stay on, Gretchen. We'll get some contact information for you, and I will do what I can. You know that the housing authorities are independent, and one proposal that's been sitting for some while is to consolidate.
I am so for that proposal.
So that we have fewer of them and more transparency, if you will, around them. It hasn't moved very far in the legislature, but let me find out about your situation, and we'll do what we can.
Gretchen, don't go away. I'm sorry.
Just Gretchen, one more question: was the paving project that you mentioned, was that around curb cuts and that sort of thing?
It was a complete paving project. We have a very long drive that comes by the building that is beside the building, and it's where our parking is.
Yes.
It's curb cuts. It's handicapped access. It's the whole package.
And are you saying that when you say it's not compliant with the ADA, you mean there are no curb cuts, that kind of thing?
It's not accessible, right? The grade has been the grade is not correct.
I see.
And the doors, we have no accessible doors out to the pavement.
Yes.
And that was part of the project.
Yes.
Gretchen,
yes,
do not go away. Stay on hold, and one of our producers will get your number and give it to the governor's office. Governor, just in a minute before you have to take a break. You speaking of putting your foot on the gas, as you mentioned a minute ago, I think I get this right. The Highway Trust Fund money, which is very important to states, including ours. My understanding
is federal,
runs out in the fall, in October
it's
or something.
Crazy.
When you were here last month, I said to you, what regret do you have about something that you know will not be accomplished before you leave office? You didn't want to answer. Then you finally said transportation infrastructure stuff is a lot more to be done.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me the potential consequence of this is horrific. What's the deal?
Well, it's there's some estimates that 50% of the bridge projects that we have on deck would have to slow or stall if the Highway Trust Fund is not replenished at the federal level. We are investing a lot of state money, as I think you know, and we've talked about in the past, in infrastructure rebuild and catching up. But there's so much to do, and it's vital work, and it creates jobs as well, both direct and indirect jobs. There's a project out in Springfield. It's on I-91. It's a viaduct project. I don't know if you know Springfield, but I-91 sort of cuts the downtown off from the Connecticut River, and there's a viaduct which is the main artery into downtown Springfield and connecting Connecticut to Northern Pioneer Valley, and that viaduct project needs to start. It's a few years past due, And it's going to have to be done in a way that we can keep the roadway open, at least in part. But if it doesn't start soon, the roadway is going to have to close. And that is huge in that part of the Commonwealth. And it's a project where I think 50% of it depends on federal reimbursement.
Speaking of transportation, before we go to the break, there's a photograph of you smiling, stylized, I should say, in this month's Boston
it's
Magazine,
great.
Saying that you're riding the blue line at 2:29 a.m., which I find moderately hard to believe.
I'm rarely up at 2:29 a.m.
So that is a stylized, slightly fictionalized
I haven't seen the yes is the answer. I haven't seen
the
photograph.
I'll show it to you during the break.
The
you look good, but it does say 2:29 a.m. at whatever.
Okay, we are with Governor Deval Patrick until the top of the hour. So please call and email 877-301-8970. I'm sorry I haven't gotten to all the emails. There's a lot of them, but I'll
Can
do
I
my
say
best.
That I am now looking at this photograph?
Yeah.
Who rides the subway like this?
Get Boston Magazine. It's quite a photo.
It's a great picture. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We'll be right back with more of Governor Deval Patrick.
WGBH sustainers keep this station going strong through convenient monthly installments that renew automatically. So right now, WGBH is giving credit where credit is due.
Jim Fitzgerald.
Kim Draper.
Deborah Farwell.
Susan B. Jones.
Sandra Papson.
Ron and Linda Morse.
Elizabeth Eaton.
Thank you. To earn your own WGBH production credit, visit wgbh.org/sustainer.
WGBH Radio exists because of you. And HBX, the online learning initiative powered by Harvard Business School faculty for college sophomores, juniors, and seniors who want to learn the language of business. Accepting applications for June at hbx.hbs.edu. And from Aesthetic Reconstructive and Implant Dentistry, Newton Wellesley, committed to providing a patient-centered, minimally invasive, and scientific approach to dental care and patients' overall health. More at aridnw.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan, and he is Deval Patrick. He's the governor of the Commonwealth. Once a month, he comes in here for an hour to take our questions and yours, and this is that hour. Before we get back to the calls, Governor, at 877-301-8970, there was a story that I have a feeling touched a nerve with you in the Globe the other day about a study that had been done about the achievement gap and more in Boston, that two-thirds of the teens, 19 and under, mm-hmm. in Boston are blacks and Latinos, men, I should mm-hmm. say, males. And they go on to quote all these statistics that 49.8% of Latinos, 44 plus point something of blacks are on public assistance by the age of 15. It's the numbers for whites, white teens are fewer, less than half of that. Education, the whole deal. James Jennings did this study out of Tufts, who I'm assuming you know, and he did a study 4 years ago about, I think it was called the State of Black Boston or something like that. There's study after study after study. I know you've talked about it a lot in your 7 years in office. Are we making concrete progress on that front, or is it more talking the talk and not walking the walk?
No, I think we're making progress, but I think it is not fast or dramatic enough. The issues around black and brown men, young men in Boston are not unlike those in other gateway cities. And they don't lend themselves to just one solution because poverty isn't like that. It's a combination of education. It's access to it's the creation of jobs, but it's also access to those jobs. And transportation has something to do with that. It's middle skills training, the sort of thing we're trying to do at the RocksMap project we've talked about before, where we have teamed Roxbury Community College up with Madison Park across the street, so that seniors graduating from Madison Park have not just the opportunity to take college level courses, but have 1 and in best cases 2 years toward their junior college degree. The pathways initiatives, and there are a number of them, both public and private, that connect up specific individuals to specific jobs within, you know, a short subway ride of the communities we're talking about are some of the fastest growing entities in the Commonwealth. The opioid and substance abuse issues are affecting those neighborhoods just like they are in the suburbs, and they have been for longer than they were in the suburbs. And we're and they bring some more concentrated attention on that as well. I was at a at a gathering of black men and boys on Saturday morning. I think it was called Breakfast for Brothers, and they get together once a month. It's in Mattapan. They get together once a month, and they talk about. They talk to these young men and with these young men about becoming men. And they, you know, in a lot of cases, the kids there, and indeed the adults there, grew up without a man in the household. And they talk about that, and they get these young men to express themselves and also understand that the expectations of them are high by the men in the room. And so some of that social engagement, for lack of a better term, that very human engagement, that sort of, you know, the community taking responsibility for its community members is also, I think, a part of the solution. And bit by bit, it's happening.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor Deval Patrick, 877-301-8970.
Let's see. Sally is calling from Danvers. Sally, you there?
Hi, Sally.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
How are you?
Marjorie.
Hi.
Hi, Governor. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
This is not Sally as in former state rep Sally, is it?
It is.
Sally Kearns, who was a state rep a century ago. I hope I didn't out you, Sally, but I recognized your voice.
How did you know? Oh, okay, I was going
to
say.
I recognize your voice. Good to speak to you, Sally. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That gym has been around a long time.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sally.
I've now relegated myself to just doing radio call-in shows.
Apparently you and me both, Sally.
I'm sorry, Sally. Go ahead.
All right. Well, Governor, you've talked about some of the things that are connected to the issue that I want to raise, mm-hmm. which is children, homeless children living in motel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Not only in Danvers, I think there are about seven communities, Waltham, Brighton, and some other places.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have a lot on your plate. I know that this is a complicated, thorny problem. DCF, I think, is part of this as well, to the extent that some of these families need to be on someone's radar screen for support and services.
Mm-hmm.
I want to raise the issue of just the most fundamental matter of safety.
Mm-hmm.
In Danvers, anyway, they're in motel rooms. So, you know, three people in a motel room, and they have to walk on Route 114 or Route 1 to get to a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, you know, if you could get with Rich Davey and you could get some of your team. I know Aaron is working hard and the nonprofit community, which is tremendous,
mm-hmm.
you know, and ready to go to work on it. So mm-hmm. I just want to put it on your radar screen, keep it on your radar screen. Do you see a path to ending the policy, and what would it be?
Well, I thank you. I'll tell you what I think and what I'm worried about, and then Sally, I'd love to hear what you think some of the solutions might be, because there's by no means consensus. There are a lot of families and a lot more families since the recession who are homeless, and I do want to, you know, it reminds me to go back to a conversation we were having a minute ago, Marjorie, about how well the economy is doing. The recovery has not touched everybody.
Correct.
And we need to be mindful of that. I certainly am. We have, and I have to tell you personally, I hate motels as the solution, but for families, it is frequently a better solution than a shelter. The best solution, obviously, is permanent housing, and the rental voucher program, which is one of the tools, Sally, that we've been using. The legislature in the current budget it looks like they're going to amp that up a little bit. But the availability of that housing, let alone having a voucher for it, is a serious problem. I went out to Chelsea yesterday to the Box District, where in 6 months they put up really beautiful modular housing. modular housing. So it comes in on a trailer, and they screw it all together, and then they do the finishes, and it's gorgeous. And some of it is.
Danvers is certainly doing. We're you know, exceeding, I think, our requirement, trying to move quickly. There's a habitat project going on.
Yep.
Yeah, it can be done.
Yeah.
It can be done.
Yeah. So I think these are some sort of combinations of solutions. The Aaron has a view, and by the way, for those who don't know who we're talking about, Aaron Gornstein is the head of the housing division in state government, and is a really terrific and experienced and very thoughtful leader on these issues. And one of the things he's been looking at is more congregate housing. But I would tell you, we're not getting a lot of traction on that in the legislature so far. And I'm worried that simply doing tomorrow what we do today is not going to get us really ahead of the game.
Sally, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for the call. Hope to speak to you again.
Thank you, Sally, for calling in. Let's go back to the calls, please, Governor.
Michael is calling from the car. Michael, you there?
Hi, Michael.
Yes, hi, Marge and Jim and Governor.
Are you using hands-free?
I'm pulled over.
There you go.
Good for you.
There you go.
Wow.
And I think you should rename the segment to What's Your Gripe?
What's yours, Michael?
And I have a gripe, too. But I'd like to take a moment to commend you on your efforts in renewable energy, and in particular solar.
Mm-hmm.
This state, as we all know, or at least we should know, is becoming a national model for solar in this country. And it's because of efforts that you've put in through the Green Communities Act and the Solar Carve-Out Program and the Mass Clean Energy Center.
Mm-hmm.
But my gripe is, now that we have such a successful program, why are they contemplating eliminating the solar rebate?
You mean for homeowners, for example?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I'm an installer of solar. I've been waiting for the time in this country where renewable energy was a viable business.
Right.
And it's been a long wait.
Right.
It's been over 40 years. And it's now finally, and you mentioned job creation in this state.
Yeah.
And it's not a coincidence that in the last 4 years, when job creation has increased, solar jobs have
exploded.
Exploding.
Yeah.
So now we have a recipe for success.
Yep.
And the state is thinking about eliminating the rebate program, which, by the way, customers tell me if it weren't for the rebate, they wouldn't install solar on their roofs.
Yep. So it's a great question, and the question I think that the team is trying to sort out is not whether to eliminate it, but whether to change it. And it has a lot to do with Michael, with the fact, as you will know, entry level costs of solar have fallen dramatically. So the rebate is attractive. In fact, I used it when we did solar out in the Berkshire. Berkshire's 4 or 5 years ago, and we wouldn't have been able to afford it without the rebate, which was brilliant. And the question is, do we sustain it in its present form, or do we do something different to take account of the fact that many types of installations have fallen dramatically in cost?
Michael, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Can I make one more comment?
Quickly,
if
you
would.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah. Prices have come down, but there's still a tremendous sticker shock for the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to look at a $40,000 investment, which is approximately what it costs for an average household, is huge. Now, the money comes from the renewable energy charge on everybody's utility bill. So it's self-funded.
Mm-hmm.
And to make changes to the program, they're not talking about changing it. They're talking about eliminating. I just sent in a comment today, as a matter of fact. The comment period is until next Tuesday. They're contemplating, DOER is contemplating a solar loan program to basically replace it. But that's coming from a different funding source. That's coming from the ACP of the SREC program. So you should have both. If you had a solar loan program and the rebate program, I mean, this and the other thing.
Well, you might be right, Michael. I don't think that it's a sin to consider whether it's time to update the rebate program, and that's what they're doing and what they're supposed to do. And I think there are going to be a lot of comments like yours that we're on a roll, so don't touch it, leave it be. And there are going to be some comments about how to strengthen it going forward. So it's a process, and I welcome your participation in the process.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. You're listening to What's Your Gripe with Governor Deval Patrick. Governor, speaking of gripes, a lot of people, and you included, are griping about the healthcare website. Most people know it was in terrific shape, and then all of a sudden the Affordable Care Act connection put it into a bit of a tailspin. Mm. Reports are we're going to be spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $100+ million to either get a brand new website, or if that doesn't come together by the new sign-up period, open enrollment period in the fall, then we'd allegedly or potentially connect to the feds. Two things. One, what's the likelihood of getting most or all of that $100+ million paid for by the feds? Mm-hmm. And two, do you blame yourself for any of the problems we've had with the website in the state?
Well, Jim, on your second question, I'm the governor, so I'm responsible for all of it. It's enormously frustrating. This is especially, this was a privatized project, and the private vendor failed us and failed us miserably.
This is CGI we're talking about, is that correct?
It's the same vendor who built the federal website. And a number of other states, and of course, when you turn it over, as we have, although we will ultimately own the intellectual property, the code and stuff like that, they have control of it right now. So even figuring out how much of it we can use on a go forward basis is a pretty delicate negotiation with them. So we're unwinding. From CGI, the alternatives are not to build a brand new one. It's actually to build off that which we have already bought that we can use, or to use on a temporary basis the federal website. And the problem with the federal website is that although it is functioning well, it doesn't do all the stuff that our own health reform does. Our own health reform provides some affordability subsidies that are not provided at the national level. I don't think anybody wants to walk back from that. So it's incredibly frustrating, and there is risk involved. Although I will say, Sarah Islin and now Maydad Cohen, who are running the project to fix it and make it right, have been doing an incredible job, and they've been really on the consultant who's helping us and on CGI and the new vendor that we are engaged with, but they've also been quite candid. There's risk involved in getting it right. Now you asked a question about who's going to pay for it. I mean, we're all taxpayers, federal and state, so we are all going to pay for it. So far, the money has come from the federal government. We've asked, we've told the federal government what the budget may be. That's an upper limit budget, by the way, to get us a fix, and we're in conversation with them. I don't know how it's all going to short.
Thing before we go back to the phones. Olga Roche, of course, is gone as the head of DCF, and a new commissioner is there, Erin Devaney. She was an attorney.
An interim commissioner.
An interim, right. Yeah. Well, and I bring her up because I'm wondering how interim she is. She's not giving any interviews, and I thought there was some sort of message here that meant she was just there for a short time, and you have a new permanent person in
mind. But I'm going to announce today?
Not today, but maybe tomorrow or next week. Are you looking for a new permanent?
No, we are.
You are?
Yeah, yeah.
So there could be a new permanent head before you leave office.
Yes, that's a hope. That's not easy to do, by the way, when you're in the end of your term and you're in a you're talking about an agency that takes this much incoming, deservedly or not. Every day, I will say for folks who have, and there have been a number who expressed some concern that the person who is the interim commissioner doesn't have a background in child welfare. That in fairness, she was the deputy for operations in this agency,
right?
Before she stepped up, and I really appreciate her stepping up. She knows the agency. We had a commissioner who had 30 years of experience in child welfare. I'm not sure that's where the gap is right now. It's much more about how we implement the reforms that, in terms of additional staffing and technology, that the legislature has so far supported. And there may be more when we finally get the report from the outside expert. So we're looking for someone who has that blend of child welfare sort of substantive depth and also management skill, and I hope we can close on that soon. And the acting commissioner, I hope, will be a candidate.
Okay. Let's go back to the calls, Governor DeVal Patrick.
Let's see. Sean is calling from Groveland. Sean, you there?
Hi, Sean.
Good afternoon, Governor.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
Yesterday, I was part of a group that delivered a petition to your office mm-hmm. about the parole of juvenile killers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if you had time to view that petition and what your position may be today.
I haven't seen the petition. I know you were there. I'm sorry that I didn't get to see you. I have heard a lot about the. Were you guys at the hearing yesterday?
We certainly were.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot about the hearing. For the listeners who don't know what we're talking about, and Sean, you please fill in if I don't get it right. There was a hearing yesterday on legislation in the wake of a Supreme Court decision that said that it was that automatic life without parole for juvenile murderers was unconstitutional. And the hearing was about setting what the minimum ought to be before eligibility for parole. Is that fair, Sean?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think the proponent – there are a couple of bills. We filed one, which I think was in the 20 to 25-year range. I think the one that was heard yesterday – maybe they were all heard yesterday, but the one that got the attention was the 35-year minimum, right?
Correct.
Right. And then I think there's this a separate question about what happens with people who are already convicted, who may be eligible for parole as a result of that decision today. Is that I think is what the petition was about.
The petition is certainly about retroactivity,
yeah.
where these cases are long since closed.
Yeah,
and you know, the victims' families here find it particularly unjust to go backwards in an effort to just parole. A few of the offenders that may or may not have been simply accomplices,
mm-hmm.
When those efforts certainly could have been resolved by clemency
mm-hmm.
on your part.
Mm-hmm. Clemency meaning?
Or a pardon. I mean, if of the 63 offenders, there yeah. are, we'll call it 20, just
yeah.
for number's sake, wouldn't it have been easier to take those types of actions or to find a way to parole just those individuals rather than actual killers? You know what I'm saying?
I think so. But, I mean, there aren't any – I haven't gotten any recommendations from the parole board so far. So I think this may be about what we do in the event the cases come forward. And I would look at the petition. I don't think there's any predisposition one way or another on my part or on the part of the parole board. Obviously,
actually, that predisposition is what is disturbing victims' families. Or it seems that – The ruling came down on Christmas Eve without really having a road to drive on. The parole board doesn't have any parameters to take first-degree murderers' hearings.
Yeah.
They only have second-degree murderers. And
yeah.
at this point, there's no separation between first and second degree. They're treated the same. There has to be clear distinction between those two.
Well, that's a fair point, but don't fuss at me about what the judiciary does. They're separate. The question now is, what is the parole board supposed to do within the parameters the judiciary has set up? And I appreciate the point of view expressed in the petition, and I will look at it, and I will see that they look at it too.
Sean, thanks for the call, Governor. You're speaking of parole and the judicial system, which made me think, which I hadn't before, about the Governor's Council, which ultimately decides whether or not there will be judges who you nominate or not. And you recently had a nominee who was rejected by the Governor's Council,
mm-hmm.
Who, with a controversy I don't think we really need to get into.
You're talking about the Superior Court nominee?
The guy who had been connected to the ADL,
right,
and
right,
even
right.
though he had
yep.
protested within the ADL their position about the Armenian Genocide, etc.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't think that's important to get into for the moment. My question is this. In the past, there have been constitutional amendments proposed, including actually by your state senator, I don't know if he supports it anymore, Brian Joyce, to eliminate the Governor's Council and have judges picked and confirmed, like they are, for example, in the United States Senate,
mm-hmm.
Supreme Court justices. If you were asked to testify at that, how would you testify? Get rid of the Governor's Council or no?
I think we need a Governor's Council. I think we certainly need some check on any governor's power to appoint to the bench. I don't like the systems of elected judges. I've practiced in those in those jurisdictions, and I think they are fraught for a whole other series of reasons. And for all of the reporting and the, you know, the occasional frustration, like with the candidate you you mentioned, the Governor's Council has confirmed, I think I've appointed 150 or 60 judges, and all but two, I think I'm right about this, they've said yes. So it's not like the record has been bad. Some of the outcomes are not not great. Some of the hearings are not pleasant. To say the least, to be sure. And I think the Governor's Council is aware of that. Is self-conscious about that and the criticism they are getting. But it, you know, far be it for me to complain about the sort of the record of outcomes overall.
My problem with it very quickly, and the reason I broach it not very articulately, was the vast majority of people in the Commonwealth have no idea who their governor's counselor is,
well,
as opposed to a state senator who arguably you know, and wouldn't you be good if you knew who it was who was deciding whether a man or a woman should be a judge in the Commonwealth?
Well, okay. I mean, it's fair that that's a fair point. I don't know that you can blame the governor's council for the fact that the people who vote for them don't know who they are. You know, it's up to us to get informed, be informed about who our counselors are and what their record of decision and behavior has been, and to choose accordingly.
Do you have any idea who your governor's counselor is, Mr. Browdy, over there?
I told you, it is the father of a nice young woman who stopped me as I went into the polling booth in Central Square and said, "Please vote for my father."
I have covered the hearings. I have no idea who my governor's counselor is.
Do you know who yours is?
I do.
Oh, you do? Okay, fine. Oh,
he's trying to catch you on that one, Governor. You know, you're giving a commencement address this weekend, I believe, at Boston University.
I am.
So have you got it all worked up?
No,
you know,
I don't.
Really? Under a lot of pressure?
I am.
You had a great commencement speaker our producer, Chelsea Murs, found today when you graduated from Harvard. Do you remember?
Oh, this is good.
Was it Solzhenitsyn?
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Good How about research. That?
And you are both of the gotcha journalism school.
Yes, we are.
And I beat it back
you
both
did,
times.
Yes, you
well,
did.
We're talking about this in a few minutes with Alex Beam, who's coming in a few minutes after you leave. But I guess everybody's expecting he was going to give this big speech because, of course, he was in exile in Russia.
Right.
The Soviet Union was still there. He's going to come in and praise the United States and stuff. And he did just the opposite, chastising the arrogance and smugness of Western materialist culture. And you've forgotten all about it.
So this is the other thing that that one must remember if you are giving a commencement address, which is though you should prepare and be serious and thoughtful and appropriate to the occasion, most of the people there won't remember a single thing you said.
It's awful,
if not indeed who spoke at their graduation.
Are you troubled by the fact that there's been this, I don't know we're going to get into this, but just for a second, by the fact that the Condi Rices of the world stepped back from Rutgers when there was a protest as a commencement speaker? The head of the IMF, what was her name, Lagarde, I think,
just
stepped out of the commencement address at one of your daughters and one of my daughters' school, Smith.
Mm.
That happened to a woman at Brandeis who's been very critical of Islam.
She was an honorary degree, though. She wasn't a...
Oh, she wasn't a commencement? No. My apologies. Does that trouble you that there's this...
Well, all the situations are different, Jim. I'm not following the news on all of those, so I don't want to comment, but you know, the one thing people I'm in a time in my life and career where people are asking me constantly, "What are you going to do next?
What are you going to do next?"
And there it is, there it is. And the one thing I am certain I don't want to do, but that has been suggested to me from time to time, is to be a university president. Because I say to people, "Look, I'm getting out of politics."
It is the dental floss speech. I thought was a very good one that the woman gave. The reporter talked about things you should do in your life.
And oh, it's one of the most famous Chicago Tribune columnists.
Be sure
was it?
Dental floss, wear sunscreen. She was great.
I can felt use that on
and
Sunday.
It was absolutely brilliant. And the guy George Sanders that gave the great address about people, kindness, the need for kindness in the world,
actually,
which he has turned into a best-selling book. So, Governor, this could be a big opportunity.
Well, no, isn't that interesting? I'm so glad you told me that. It must have been fated because I was going in that direction for Sunday, but I evidently have to think of a new direction now.
No,
thank
why
you
not? You could just quote him. Or the guy at Wellesley High School that got up and told all the graduates.
McCulloch's kid.
That they weren't special. Deal with
it. You really followed
this,
don't you?
Well, I'm waiting for someone to ask me.
Have you written the speech that perhaps I could use?
I've got my speech already, Governor, but no one has asked me to deliver it. So
it's
maybe
coming,
one
Marjorie,
of these days.
Me.
Maybe my middle school, my junior high school in Fall River. I don't know.
I tried getting to invite you. It didn't work out. By the way, what we say at the end of every hour where the governor is kind enough to join us and you is that everybody who is on hold, stay there. We'll get your phone number. Everybody who is emailed,
yes,
we will forward the emails.
I apologize because there have been so many emails. We were deluged with emails, and I've only gotten to read half of them. So I apologize to the people that emailed, but we'll hold on to
them. It's because you kept talking
it's
about
true.
The commencement address.
It's
she spoke
true.
Too much.
We'll sorry.
Forward them all to the
Usually
governor's
it's Jim
office.
Who does all the
I know. Well, certain
voiceover.
Topics really get me going, you know.
He knows the lingo. Governor, it's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
And we will see you in June.
Thank you. Be well.
Governor Deval Patrick.
Deval Patrick joins us every month for Ask the Governor, and thanks again for being with us, Governor Patrick. When we come back, it is time for Open Mic with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. We're going to talk to him about Alexander Solzhenitsyn and bounce commencement speakers and also get his take on the ouster of the New York Times editor Jill Abramson. That's coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.